you very much. It's my pleasure to be here. It's my pleasure to be in Prague every time. I'm going to speak about word formation viewed from the typological point of view. It means I'm going to concentrate on the crossroads of these two areas of linguistics. As for the typological perspective, I will deal with the synchronic approach, and partly I will refer to some diachronic data. I will start with some background information, then I will concentrate on methodological and theoretical principles of our research, and then I will introduce some of the results. The background information is very simple. This area is an untilled area. If you go through, for example, walls, you hardly find any data on word formation in this database. If you browse through descriptive grammars, they mostly concentrate on inflectional morphology. If you have a look at Franz Planck's Universals Archive, very few universals from the field of word formation. So generally, it is claimed that it is a poorly studied area, and this can be demonstrated by two citations dating back to 2001 and 2005, both of them maintaining that this is an under-researched area of word formation and that it is necessary to pay more attention to this field. If you realize this, there has been a lot of typological work in the field of phonology, inflection morphology, syntax, but word formation, for certain reasons I will discuss later, is neglected almost totally. We started to deal with the typology of word formation some 15 years ago, but we very soon realized that it's a rather complicated project. I try to summarize the reasons. So first of all, it is the lack of comparable data for a substantial number of languages. While descriptive grammars, as I already mentioned, pay much attention to inflection, word formation is almost totally neglected. And if you try to get the data on minor languages, it is rather difficult, and simply you don't get the data for a typological research from descriptive grammars. Another reason why the typological research into word formation is problematic concerns the growing awareness of fuzzy boundaries between inflection and derivation. For example, there have been several articles, research papers on this issue. If you put together all the criteria for the distinction between inflection and derivation, you will find out there are more than three dozen criteria. None of them is reliable. Reliable in terms of individual languages, because in individual languages you can identify a number of exceptions. What is inflection? What is derivational? But the problem is more serious if you go through many languages. What is inflectional in one language is derivational in another language, and vice versa. So this is one problem. Another problem concerns absence of generally applicable method, method of comparison. What can be taken as a criterion for comparing many languages? I will get to it later. And this concerns certainly what should count as comparable concepts in the field of word formation. So these are basically the topics I will discuss in the first part of my lecture. Okay. So let me briefly summarize the basic research principles. We studied 73 European languages that represent 22 genera and 7 language families. From the perspective of aerial linguistics, all of them fall within a single territory labeled by WRF as standard average European. Now, what was the method of selection of these languages? We very soon found out that we cannot rely on walls, we cannot rely on ethnologue, because they provide different lists of languages. What is included in walls doesn't have to be included in ethnologue, and vice versa. The numbers of languages included and described in these databases substantially differ for various reasons. So, what we decided to do was to rely on the most recent publication on word formation. It is Miller, Onheiser, Olsen, and Reiner, HSK word formation. It is a huge project. It was a huge project by Mouton, including dozens of chapters. The first part concerns theoretical chapters, and the second part of this handbook includes description of word formation systems in 73 languages. So to simplify things, we decided to follow the number of languages as presented in this handbook. Another problem which we faced was the completeness of data provided here. Certainly, we could not rely only on the data provided in these chapters, because our list of parameters was much longer than we could get the data from the chapters. So basically, we relied on various sources. We've been collecting data on word formation for some 20 years now. We have our own word formation database, and this database was developed on the basis of an analysis of a limited number of data in descriptive grammars. We completed it with Mouton's data, and importantly, we had very vivid communication with experts, morphologists, usually experts in word formation, representing individual languages. So it took us years, many years, to get a more or less representative sample of data. Now, certainly it is not easy to develop a database in word formation because there are various theoretical approaches. This bears on every single linguistic discipline. So we face the same problem. We try to follow Dixon's principle of theory-neutral approach wherever possible, A case in point was what is in English tradition labeled as conversion, what Dockerill calls transflection, what is by some authors, for example, Boy, labeled as paradigmatic formation or Szymanek, and what is, for example, by Marchand or Kastowski, labeled as zero derivation. So if we ignore zero derivation, criticized by many, all these theoretical approaches have in common the fact that it is a non-concatenative word formation that we produce a new word by changing the word class. Yeah? So this is an example of theory neutral approach. This couldn't be adhered to in some other cases, like the case of what we call postfixation, and this is a violation of Greenberg's universal number 28, saying that inflectional morphemes follow derivational morphemes. In this case, we faced two different approaches. Gruzdieva, in personal communication, objected to our inclusion of sa suffixes in postfixation, because she claims that clitics go back to lexical elements, and therefore these cases do not imply a violation of Greenberg's universal. Now, what we decided to follow was the traditional approach, also clearly demonstrated in Mouton's handbook, where almost every single author of language-specific chapter claimed that this is postfixation and that the reflexive suffix sa, tsa in Belarusian sa, and so on in individual languages are derivational suffixes. Yes, there were two options, either follow Gruzdieva's approach or to adhere to what Slavic linguists claim in the approaches. So this was the matter of a decision. Finally, in the case of, for example, back formation, it was rather difficult. I think 2 years ago, I published a paper on back formation for this Mouton's handbook, and I analyzed different approaches to back formation, and I was totally lost, because there are so many different approaches to back formation that you simply cannot choose one. Marchand, Kastowski, and Aronov maintain that back formation has only diachronic relevance, and that from the synchronic point of view, it is on a par with affixation. Yeah, Kastowski's equation is well known, and it claims that it is just from the synchronic point of view, it is suffixation. Kiparski treats it as the case of compounding, Boy as paradigmatic word formation, Nagano conversion with subsequent clipping, Anderson synchronically non-rule-based process, Hall and Kastowski non-incorporation. So many different approaches, each resulting in different sort of data. So in our view, back formation really has merely diachronic relevance, and therefore we decided to drop it from apologies. Yes, from our research. Now, Okay, I apologize. I am total ignorant. So now another problem concerns data comparison. As the first idea that comes to your mind when you want to compare word formation is to compare the productivity of individual word formation processes, word formation rules, and so on. And then you realize that this criterion is not applicable. Why? First of all, there are basically two methods of productivity calculation or computation. One proposed by Aronoff that it relies on dictionary data. Bayan's approach relies on corpora. The first, there are theoretical and practical problems with these two approaches. The first problem concerns the restriction to affixation. If you want to objectively evaluate the productivity of word formation processes or rules, you cannot ignore competing processes and rules, because then the data, the results will be distorted. So you can calculate the productivity and the competition according to Aronoff and Bayan only and exclusively within affixation, but this is a biased approach. If we realize the many different ways how we can produce, for example, for illustration, agent nouns in English, you can see that there are many different rules that produce agent nouns. This is an overview. I don't claim that this list is complete, but it not only includes affixation, but also conversion and compounding, different kinds of compounding. And it means that you cannot ignore all these ways of forming agent nouns. So if you wish to get a realistic picture of productivity of individual word formation rules, you must take into consideration all these different ways of forming agent nouns in this case. Another problem with Bayan's approach concerns hapax legomena. He claims that single occurrence of a word in the corpus indicates its novelty. Okay, but it can also indicate an archaic word. It's one aspect. And the other aspect, the other problem is that why not two occurrences? Why not three occurrences? Where is the boundary for novelty, for the evaluation of novelty? Yeah? Next, while there is British National Corpus, which is truly representative, but you cannot use not all languages provide such a representative corpus. Ethnologue classifies languages into 13 statuses according to the quality of dictionaries, quality of corpora, according to the usage of language in communication, various areas of communication. And I think that only the first five languages in the first five statuses meet the requirement of high quality corpus or dictionary. So certainly, if you want to compare languages and only a small fraction of these languages have representative corpora or dictionaries, there's no way out of this situation. Then, I have already mentioned fuzzy boundaries between derivation and inflection, and now if Aronoff wants to introduce a well-known method of computation, which compares the availability with of bases with the actual realization. It means we should be able to identify actual words and potential words and nonce formation. So what actually should be included in this computation? It's not quite clear. There are fuzzy boundaries between compounds and phrases. Now, this is another problem with general approach to comparison of languages, because this not only concerns English, the well-known problems, but it is the matter of many other languages. Then, affixes versus lexical morphemes. What counts as an affix? What counts as a lexical morpheme? And if you can't sort out this problem, you cannot identify the features of individual word formation rules. Yeah? And finally, what is actually a new word? Because word formation deals with new words. What is a new word? It's clipping a new word if it is only a formal reduction of existing word. Is an acronym a new word? What belongs to inflection and to derivation? Is comparative and superlative the matter of inflection or the matter of derivation? From the point of view of evaluative morphology, it is derivation. From the approach of traditional grammar, it is inflection. There are many questions that are not answered and that make comparative research, cross-linguistic comparative research, problematic. And so in the end, we came up with a new idea. All this project, I shouldn't forget, is a joint project with Livia Kurtvesi, and she came in in dealing with evaluative morphology with the proposal of structural richness as a criterion for the comparison of languages. So she understands structural richness as the degree to which a particular word formation system makes use of all the available options. This is important. This is crucial. We are not interested in the productivity index, in the productivity rate, or whatever we call the result of productivity computation. We are interested in the possibility or capacity of a particular rule to synchronically produce a new word. It means if a rule can produce new words from the synchronic point of view, it is considered as an inherent part of the word formation system from the synchronic point of view. So productivity is the synchronic capacity to produce new complex words without regard to the number of new words produced. So we are not interested in the productivity rate, how many new words, but whether or not we can produce new words by a particular rule. And the quantitative expression of the structural richness is the so-called saturation value. As I mentioned, Kurtvesi, 2050, first introduced the parameter of saturation value. So, what is the advantage of the structural richness? It is independent of all the problems I mentioned when talking about the productivity computation. by Aronoff's or Bayan's methods. And what is, I think, the most important aspect of this approach is that we only take into account prototypical cases. If you consider only prototypical cases, it means that you avoid all the fuzzy boundary problems. All the fuzzy boundary problems. And this makes the comparison of languages much smoother. This approach enables us to identify preferred word formation strategies in the sample languages. It means that we can identify whether a particular language concentrates on compounding or some rules of compounding exclusively in producing new words. And another language may make use of a much broader range of word formation rules or processes. I will demonstrate it later. And this approach enabled us to compare the languages from various perspectives within one language, or to compare several languages, to compare language genera, to compare language families, to compare, to evaluate language areas. So, based on this method, we included in our research 100 comparables. We use the term comparables instead of Haspelmath term comparative concept. Who you may know that Haspelmath distinguishes between comparable concepts and descriptive features. It means descriptive features are bound to individual languages and comparable concepts are universally applicable. There are certain problems with his term comparative concept, and therefore we decided to avoid, I can't go into these problems now, but we use the term comparables. We employed 100 comparables of the following sort. So there are processes like suffixation, there are types, class maintaining, class changing, and there are features, it means comparables, for individual word formation processes. In this case, suffixation. As you can see, they are heavily based on semasiological data, on the postulation of word classes and changes resulting from the word, from the application of a particular word formation rule, class maintaining or class changing. So these are comparables evaluated for suffixation as an example. We worked with two basic types of saturation value, absolute and relative. Absolute saturation value indicates how many comparables are employed by a particular word formation system in the formation of new words. So if you have 100 comparables, it is the availability of the system possibilities. And now if you count, for example, some languages make use of 35 features comparables, so it is the absolute saturation value, very simple. But if we want to compare the relative contribution of individual word formation processes like compounding, suffixation, prefixation, they are represented in our sample by different number of comparables for obvious reasons. And so we need to calculate the relative saturation value, which is calculated in a simple way. Actual comparables, it means comparables that are actually used by the word formation system of a particular language, and it is divided by the number of comparables for a particular word formation process, for example, by 27 in compounding. Now, a few results. The first table indicates the structural richness of word formation systems in 22 language genera. As you can see, it is an average here. Yeah? As you can see, the high structural richness in our research sample can be identified for Northwest Caucasian and next Slavic. We must interpret this data carefully because of different number of languages per genus in the sample. There were only three Northwest Caucasian languages evaluated within Europe in our sample, and there were many more languages evaluated within Slavic genus, Germanic genus, and so on. But what is interesting is the huge differences in differences among languages. Yeah, 45% means that out of 100 comparables, for example, Slavic makes use of 44%, but Lezgic only 21. So this is interesting, and it can be further analyzed for what reasons. The diversity of word formation rules in Slavic or Germanic is much higher than that in Lezgic. Then, structural richness of word formation processes in relation to each. So, we counted every single process, for example, compounding, as productive if at least one of the comparables included in our research was used to form new complex words. So if you have, for example, 17 suffixation comparables and a particular language makes use one of them for the formation of new complex words, suffixation is treated as the productive way of word formation. From this, it follows that, once again, the Slavic genus features the high structural richness. It means 67% of word formation processes is utilized for the formation of new words. So what is interesting, the Germanic genus is much poorer in this respect. Then, structural richness of word formation systems in relation to language families. It means that we compared four language families. The numbers of languages per family are included in parentheses. And as you can see, there are, once again, huge differences in the utilization of individual comparables and individual word formation rules for the formation of new words. It should be pointed out, it doesn't mean that Dagestanian is poorer in the formation of new words, that it doesn't have the capacity to form new words. It means just that the number of rules used is smaller. The smaller number of words of rules produces the same as the much broader range of rules in Indo European. Yeah? We can also evaluate structural richness of word formation processes in relation to language families. The former table evaluated comparables, and this table evaluates processes. So clear dominance of the Indo-European family in terms of the number of word formation processes employed. This is the structural richness of word formation systems in 73 sample languages. It means the standard average European linguistic area. So which are the most saturated languages in terms of word formation? And as you can see, it is German, English, so two Germanic languages plus Norwegian, another Germanic language. Then there are Slavic languages, Croatian, Czech, Slovak. The structural richness is almost identical. And then we have Abkhaz. So we can say that in terms of the structural richness, the center of standard average European, the core, extends from the British Isles through Germany and Slavic languages. And this is the result which substantially differs from what was found out by Haspelmath or the Auvera in their evaluation of morphosyntactic features. And Livia Kurtvish in her evaluative morphology and our joint research in word formation demonstrate that what is the core of the standard average European heavily depends on the feature which is evaluated. Because there was a tendency by Haspelmath, Auvera, and other linguists or typologists to prove that the center of standard average European is German and Dutch, and partly Italian. Yeah? Slavic languages were totally excluded from this. And our research demonstrates that what is the core depends on the feature, on the parameter evaluated. This table illustrates structurally richest languages per genera and clearly shows that there are again huge differences. The German language, its structural richness is more than twice of Hungarian. And this can be the results represented on saturation maps, and this is what I said, that the core, the brown color, dark brown color, the core of standard average European in terms of the structural richness of word formation systems extends from the British Isles through Germany and Europe, with one or two exceptions. And that the periphery of this system, the structural richness of European languages, is analogical to geographical areas. Yeah? Geographical periphery. Actually, we classified languages into four groups with dark brown color meaning more than 50 features, more than 50 comparables in a language. The next question we tried to analyze was the measure of occurrence of basic word formation comparables in a genus. What is maximum comparable occurrence? It identifies those features that occur in all languages examined. So if I study standard average European as a whole, it means that feature occurs in all European languages of examined in a sample, or in all languages of a genus or family. Now, if we concentrate on genera, we can see that there are 23 comparables, 23 word formation rules that occur in all Slavic languages. But there are only three comparables that are common to all Lezgic languages. So again, these are big differences. If we consider this parameter, maximum comparable occurrence, in terms of all European languages, we arrive at the so-called Euroversals, European universals, universal features of European languages. Maximum comparable occurrence in the Indo-European family. So you can see that what is your Euroversal, universal in the Indo-European family, is mostly suffixation and compounding, with only two cases of prefixation. There are reasons for the absence of a particular feature in one or two languages. For example, class-changing verb to noun suffixation is absent in Budug, where actually all new nouns from deverbal nouns are formed by conversion in principle. And Authier points out that while this is a salient feature of East Caucasian languages, it is brought to the extreme in Budug. Therefore, this feature, class-changing verb to noun suffixation, which occurs in 72 languages out of 73, is absent in Budug. So in this way, we can analyze the absence of a particular feature in these universals. Now, if we analyze word formation processes in the sample languages, we can see that suffixation and compounding are universal word formation processes. They occur in all the languages. There was just one language with root and pattern, Maltese. According to the relative saturation value, which I mentioned before, is very interesting because it enables us to compare the relative contribution of individual word formation processes to the formation of new words in individual languages. From this table, it is clear how different contribution can be identified for various word formation processes. So in Slovak, suffixation, 94% of suffixation comparables are used. Yeah. In Finnish, it is 70, but in Ladin, only 41. There are striking differences in individual between individual languages. The same can be identified for conversion, which is only 16% in Finnish and 66% in Basque. So this kind of approach, this is just for illustration, enables us to analyze the relative contribution of world formation processes. And finally, the last point in my lecture concerns the diachronic aspects of world formation. The idea was the following. We wanted to know what was the development of individual groups of languages from the postulated proto-language. So our statistician helped us with computing the variation coefficient, and it is obvious that the most homogeneous systems of word formation can be found in Slavic and Germanic and Turkic. But the diversity of word formation systems is in Lezgik is very high. Yeah? If we evaluate these four families, the situation is similar. Altaic and Indo-European languages are homogeneous, but Uralic languages and Nag-Dagestanian languages are diverse in terms of the saturation value and the structural richness. I tried to indicate at least some of the results because there's a huge number of data. I tried to indicate the advantages of this approach presented in this lecture. So what are few conclusions from what I was talking about? I mentioned the core of the standard average European different from Haspelmann's and De Alvera. I tried to explain that it depends on the parameter that is under evaluation. From this point of view, Ugric languages, Lakhdar, Gvalezgik, Iranian, Turkic, Celtic, and Finnish, Finnic languages assume a peripheral position, and this peripheral position is analogical to the geographical position on the periphery of Europe mostly. Then the parameter of measure of occurrence makes it possible to identify universal features of a genus, of a family, of an area. There is only one absolute word formation, universal, one word formation rule, one comparable, that is employed by all 73 languages in Europe. It is noun-to-noun suffixation, so class-maintaining suffixation. But the number of statistical universals, it is above 80% of occurrence of a particular comparable, is much higher, 18 statistical universals. And finally, the central role of suffixation and compounding was postulated and confirmed because these two processes occur in all European languages. Thank you very much for your attention. You have some?
Yeah? Thank you very much, Mr. Steckauer, for your very interesting analysis and for the introduction of new data. And also, I think the idea of these comparables and the saturation was quite revealing. So thank you very much. It was out of record. And now I would like to open the floor for discussion.
Thank you. I'm wondering if I go back to your first table with the saturation values, if I'm not wrong, the highest value was 45%. So my question is...
you mean this one?
No. The very first table with 45, yeah, this one. Yeah. Is it surprising for a typologist that the value start with 45%. I mean, that it is not higher. Could it be explained in terms of language economy or?
No. There are, as I said, 100 comparables. It was our decision to include 100. We tried to map all the important word formation, generalized word formation rules. I think it is quite natural because each language has certain preferences. So, for example, Slovak, the compounding in Slovak is not very productive, and it is productive in English, for example, and German. So each language has developed its natural ways of forming new words. If you go, if you have a look, if we had a look at various word formation processes, infixation is rare. Infixation is rare, even if it was included. It is rare because it contradicts the principles of natural morphology. Yeah, it violates the integrity of words. The same applies to circumfixation. But if we want to be fair to all the processes, we couldn't ignore them. So there are processes like prefixation, suffixation, circumfixation, infixation, root and pattern, which are rare in European, reduplication, which are rare in European languages. And therefore, these processes reduce the overall numbers.
Thank you.
Thank you. So further questions?
I have a very simple, mostly technical question. It's clear that for your measurement, the importance of parts of speech categories are crucial. Did you face the problem of recognizing or distinguishing these values? Because even in Czech, with words like příbuzný, it might be a little bit controversial to say that it's only adjective or only noun. Or so did you face this problem of not being sure what category it is?
As I said, we concentrated on prototypical cases. If you say příbuzný, it is not important whether it is an adjective or a noun. The question is, can Czech produce a noun from an adjective, for example? Can Czech produce a verb from a noun, and so on? So if there are cases other than these problematic cases, we included them as prototypical. And in this way, we avoided these borderline problems, fuzzy problems. So the question whether příbuzný is a noun or an adjective doesn't play a role in this analysis. It would be important for Bayern. It would be important for Aronov, not for us. Because we can replace, you may consider příbuzný, is it derived from the verb, past participle, or is it produced by conversion or by suffix? I don't know what. But it is not important because there are other ways of forming this resulting word. Yeah? By, and these ways of forming new words are clearly identified without problems.
I can only speculate that you might be unlucky and the only occurrences would be from these boundary situations.
Yes, it is possible. And then what you can do is to consult this issue from an expert, morphologist representing a given language, and to rely to what I said, traditional approach in that, to rely on the traditional approach in the describing that language. Yeah, I don't think we faced such a problem. I can't remember. But I must admit that there has been hundreds of exchanges of emails concerning various aspects of data collection. Because, well, if you can't speak a language, you are not qualified to decide, and that's why some cases are clear, but you simply must discuss it with your informant. We were lucky. We were lucky because morphologists, maybe they represent a special group, but they were willing to cooperate, yeah, most of them. Yeah. Especially for languages which are not documented well and for which there are not representative grammars and so on. So,
yeah. So I would actually like to follow up on that. So I wonder how much is there the risk that for like well-studied languages like German, you will be able to find the cases of many of these word formation processes because the language is well studied, whereas for a language that is not studied enough, maybe some of the word formation processes do exist, only it's hard to find out that they exist because there are not enough data, not enough lexicons. So is that a risk or?
I don't think, I tried to explain, we were lucky. We had excellent informants, especially for those purely documented languages. It is not a matter of the existence of huge dictionaries in these languages, but a morphologist, I think, if he has a list of 100 comparables, 100 rules, he can identify, yes, this rule can produce new words in my language because I am able to produce such a word. I can find such a word in the list of words for that language or small dictionary. So I think that it is the capacity of every linguist to say, yes, this rule is active in our language, or it doesn't produce new words. So I would rely on the data.
Well, if I may have one remark to one of the tables. The table was on the saturation values for individual languages. And it just puzzled me that with those languages you had that, yeah, I think that one, the saturation value was around 50, I mean, not a big difference between 50 and 52. And have you some explanation for that?
These are the topmost.
Yeah,
languages.
But still, I mean, if I just look at it as a non-specialist in morphology,
yes.
I would say that the languages should differ more than shown at this table.
Yeah, but if you have a look at this table, this you can find substantial differences here for various genera. This should be reversed, Ugric, Hungarian. No. The other way around, at the top.
Yeah.
So I think these are huge differences, and to me, rather surprising that some languages, like Hungarian, this would be a question for Livia, has only 20, so I mean, one quarter of all the possibilities is made used in Hungarian. Yeah. So Hungarian is an agglutinative language,
sure.
And it makes use of affixation. Yeah, there is no prefixation, for example.
Yeah.
So automatically, 17 comparables are out. Yeah, it doesn't make use of root and pattern. It doesn't make use of infixation. I think so. it automatically mm-hmm. loses points.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Some more?
These are just these are just data, and they require a deeper analysis. What is present and why it is present or absent in individual languages.
Somebody else to
ask a question? Well, okay. So once more, I would like to thank you very much for coming, for presenting to us your project. And as far as I know, there will be a good perspective of cooperation between our group and your team. So I'm looking forward to that. Really, very,
so
very much.
Thank you very much.